This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, May 18, 2006. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. At his confirmation hearing to head the CIA, Michael Hayden defends the NSA's surveillance program. And a Senate committee holds its first hearing over internet neutrality. We'll bring you these stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. President George W. Bush today asked Congress for $1.9 billion to fund border security measures. This comes after the Senate approved legislation yesterday to build a triple-layer fence along 370 miles of the U.S. border with Mexico. The amendment's sponsor, Senator Jeff Sessions of Alabama, estimates the triple fence will cost approximately $3.2 million per mile. In Nepal, the newly reconvened parliament today unanimously endorsed a landmark proclamation that would restore the supremacy of the House of Representatives and take away nearly all of the king's powers. Carrie Byron has more from Kathmandu.
The changes to be ushered in by today's resolution are truly historic and will significantly sideline both the current king and the future of the monarchy in Nepal. Among other things, the new proclamation would drastically reduce the palace's funding allowance, make the king's income taxable, and take away the monarch's ability to choose his heir. Perhaps most importantly, the king would no longer control the national army. The new resolution will trump the country's 1990 constitution while also paving the way for the election of a constituent assembly that will decide the monarchy's future role. After the announcement of the proclamation was delayed earlier this week, ostensibly to allow officials to finish appointing a cabinet, thousands of protesters flooded back onto the streets to demand immediate action. The public reaction seems to have alarmed the government. Not only did it proceed with today's announcement in lieu of a completed cabinet, yesterday it also moved to ban any future rallies in front of either the Parliament building or the Royal Palace. While an important step, today's move does fall far short of the physical restructuring of the army that many observers say is critical to safeguard the future of democracy in Nepal. Carrie Byron, Kathmandu.
In a move seen as a widening of the gap between the legislative and executive branches of the Palestinian government, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas has deployed thousands of police throughout the Gaza Strip. Manar Jabrin reports.
The massive police deployment came just hours after the Hamas-led government sent its own special security force into Gaza streets. The new controversial special forces are made up of 3,000 men. Most are members of the Al-Qassam Brigade, the armed wing of Hamas. The new force is led by Jamal Abu Samahdana, who is wanted by the Israeli army for his role in the armed popular resistance committees. Hamas says that the security force was formed to support the police forces and other security units and to stop the chaos and instability in Gaza's streets. The formation of the new security force has heightened tension between the Hamas-led government and the administration of Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas because Abbas did not agree to the formation and the deployment of the new force. As president, Abbas is responsible for overall security. For FSRN from IMEMC.org in Palestine, I am Manar Jibrin.
Tensions remain high in Sao Paulo after 6 days of violence between the police and members of a criminal gang. Natalia Viana reports.
Even after the agreement between leaders of the crime organization First Command of the Capital, SSA, and the government, attacks occurred last night in some cities in Sao Paulo state. Official sources say PCC leaders were guaranteed physical integrity to stop the attacks. But last night, 5 buses were set on fire in Sao Paulo City, which caused some bus lines to temporarily suspend service. The transport situation is back to normal today. But the population in the favelas and city outskirts are living in constant fear. Since Friday, police have killed over 100 people suspected of involvement with the PCC. 122 people have been arrested. Neighborhood sources have told FSRN that some groups of policemen wearing civilian clothes and black ski masks have shot several innocent people. People are afraid to talk about what is happening, but those who do say the police are after revenge for the 33 police officers killed. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Natalia Viana in Sao Paulo, Brazil.
High school students in Chile took to the streets for the second time in a week, seeking answers to their demands for free university entrance exams, unlimited use of the student bus pass, and free bus trips for all students. From Santiago, FSRN's Jorge Garretón has more.
Some 150 students have been arrested so far today after high school students across the country walked out of their classes demanding the government response to their demands. But today's demonstrations, declared illegal by the government, failed to attract the large number of students of last week's massive demonstration. Last week, over 1,200 students were arrested by police throughout the country. Following last week's demonstration, the leadership of high school students met with Ministry of Education officials in an effort to reach an agreement on the students' demands. But 2 days ago, student negotiators broke off talks on free bus fares for students and free university entrance exam fee, and called for a demonstration for next week. However, yesterday, student leaders moved the demonstration for today. Ministry of Education officials told students that free bus fares would cause a rise in rates to regular users. On the free university entrance exam fees, the ministry told students that it would double the number of fee waivers to low-income students to 35,000. Today's demonstration did not have the impact of last week's massive walkout. According to the Ministry of Education, 80% of all students remain in class. For FSRN, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
Protests continue to dog the Halliburton shareholders meeting, even after the company moved the annual meeting from Houston, Texas to Duncan, Oklahoma. 16 demonstrators, including Veterans for Peace member Hiram Myers, were arrested yesterday by local police. 15 were charged with trespassing after they left the designated protest pen and attempted to enter the shareholder meeting to deliver an indictment to Halliburton's CEO. The indictment accuses the CEO of racketeering, corruption, and endangerment of U.S. troops. All of those arrested have been released. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
At his confirmation hearing for CIA Director, Michael Hayden insisted that the National Security Agency's surveillance program is legal. But he deferred many questions, saying he would answer them when the committee recesses into a closed session. Furthermore, he defended the U.S.'s treatment of detainees, saying the U.S. follows the law. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
While being questioned by Democratic Senator Carl Levin from Michigan, Lieutenant General Michael Hayden said he was an integral part in the creation of the domestic wiretapping program as head of the National Security Agency.
As I said to Senator Bond, my role was, here's technologically possible, and if we could pull that off, here's what I think the operational relevance would be. And there then followed a discussion as to why or how we could make that possible. I was issued an order on the 4th of October that laid out the underpinnings for what I described.
So you participated in the design of the specific program?
Yes, I think that's fair, Senator, yeah.
Hayden went on to defend the program, insisting on its legality. Hayden was questioned mostly about the NSA wiretapping program. Some senators on the Intelligence Committee support the program, and that was made known in their questioning. Chair of the committee, Pat Roberts.
I believe that the NSA terror surveillance program is legal. It is necessary, and without it, the American people would be less safe.
Roberts defended the program and Hayden's role several times during the hearing. But others expressed concern, but many questions were deflected, with Hayden saying that he will give an answer in a closed session that is to follow the public hearing. Senator Levin.
That he confirmed
publicly. Is that the whole program?
Senator, I'm not at liberty to talk about that in open session.
I'm not asking what the program is. I'm just simply saying is what the president described publicly, the whole program.
Senator, all I'm at liberty to say in this session is what I was talking about.
That was also his answer when asked why the NSA didn't use the courts of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Caroline Fredrickson is the director of the American Civil Liberties Union.
Well, so none of us is ever going to know whether actually he even is forthcoming in that setting. And many of the questions that were asked, I think most of us would think, are appropriately dealt with in the front of the public. They weren't asking about technical details of the program. They weren't asking about classified information. They were simply asking him about whether or not the CIA was going to abide by the law in many cases and whether the NSA had done so in the past.
Although much of the committee focused on Hayden's role at the NSA, some questions steered toward the CIA's policy on the treatment of detainees in U.S.-run prisons around the world. But most questions about detainees, Hayden said he would answer behind closed doors. Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein from California.
as principal deputy to the DNI, is it your policy that individuals may be secretly detained for decades?
Let me give you a full answer, ma'am, and let me give it to you in the closed session, but I would really be happy to answer your question.
Do you believe that the CIA is legally bound by the federal anti-torture statute and the Detainee Treatment Act adopted last year?
Yes, ma'am.
Does the president's signing statement affect CIA's compliance with this law?
Again, ma'am, I don't want to get between Article 1 and Article 2 and the inherent tensions between those, but let me answer the question as the potential director of the Central Intelligence Agency. The CIA will obey the laws of the United States and will respond to our treaty obligations.
Last year, the president added a signing statement to the McCain torture bill that said he could sidestep torture laws at any time. Hayden says the torture law applies only to Department of Defense-run facilities.
Again, the legislation does not explicitly or implicitly, I believe, bind anyone beyond the Department of Defense, Senator.
Avidan Kover is with Human Rights First. He appeared on Pacifica's live coverage of the hearing. He said Hayden's dismissal of the questions causes the public to wonder what the CIA is doing.
But what is the CIA doing? Do we pass these laws and then the CIA creates its own rules? Are the same laws, the treaties that we believe bind both the military and law enforcement, not binding on the CIA?
A majority of senators on the committee have expressed support for Hayden as CIA director before today's hearing, signaling that his confirmation is likely. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leon Caldwell.
Motions to dismiss a lawsuit against AT&T for handing millions of its customers' calling records over to the National Security Agency's surveillance program without a warrant were heard in San Francisco federal court yesterday. The Electronic Frontier Foundation is alleging AT&T broke the law, but both AT&T and the Bush administration have asked the courts to dismiss the suit and withhold evidence in the interest of national security. Christina Onestad reports.
Federal Judge Vaughn Walker rejected AT&T's motion to withhold evidence from the Electronic Frontier Foundation in its suit against the telecom for handing over customer calling records to the National Security Agency without a warrant. Judge Walker placed the documents under seal. Whistleblower and retired AT&T technician Mark Klein gave the Electronic Civil Rights Group the documents that outline AT&T's cooperation with the National Security Agency in spying on millions of AT&T customers' calling and email records. Jim Brosnahan is the attorney for Mark Klein.
All the emails, all the telephones that are connected to the emails, and all the web browsings go through the AT&T facility in those cities, and it goes into a secret government room. What he knows has never been classified, never been declared top secret. He's not cleared. He was never cleared. Everything that he did all this time was never top secret.
The suit is largely based on Klein's documents that show the NSA equipped secret rooms at AT&T offices in San Francisco, Seattle, San Jose, Los Angeles, and San Diego to wiretap AT&T customers. The foundation claims AT&T engaged in criminal activity, but AT&T is claiming immunity. Mark Bien, spokesperson for AT&T, says the company engaged in no wrongdoing.
AT&T does not provide customer information to law enforcement agencies or government agencies without legal authorization. We have an obligation to assist law enforcement and other government agencies responsible for protecting the public welfare, whether it be an individual or the security interests of an entire nation. If and when AT&T is asked by government agencies for help, we do so strictly within the law and under the most stringent conditions.
The Bush administration is also seeking to dismiss the lawsuit against AT&T, invoking a state secret privilege. The federal assistant attorney general, Carl Nichols, claims documents used in the lawsuit would violate the interests of national security. Nichols asked the court to dismiss the suit and close the hearings to the public. But foundation attorneys argue the information used in the suit against AT&T is public knowledge and not a state secret. Attorney Cindy Cohen says spying on millions of citizens is more of a threat to national security interests.
I think it's pretty hard to say that the wholesale turning over of millions of innocent Americans' communications is at all necessary to help keeping us secure. In fact, I think the reports that we're getting back out of the government about this is to the extent that that's happening, it's undermining their ability to figure out who the bad people are because there's this flood of information. You know, more haystacks doesn't help you find the needles.
Judge Walker declined the Assistant Attorney General's motion to close the public hearings. Arguments on whether the suit against AT&T would violate state secret privilege will be heard on June 23rd. Reporting from San Francisco, I'm Christina Onnestad.
The Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation held a first hearing today to introduce the Communications Act reform bill, which aims to profoundly change the way the telecommunications industry is regulated in this country. One of the bill's most debated provisions deals with internet neutrality and the concern that the cable industry would privatize the internet by charging more for preferential data delivery. Anastasia Genetsditska reports from D.C.
The Communications Act reform bill, sponsored by the Republican Senator Ted Stevens from Alaska and the Democratic Senator Daniel Inouye from Hawaii, is a bipartisan attempt to upgrade the regulation of telecommunications industry so as to keep pace with vast technological changes. Other aspect of regulation discussed is the role of the so-called Universal Service Fund, which goals, as mandated by the 1996 Act, are to allow equal access to telecom services for underprivileged consumers, such as those in low-income, rural, insular, and high-cost areas. The major debate is whether the fund represents an excessive regulation that prevents the deployment of new technology. Senator DeMint of South Carolina says this is the case.
I'm less pleased with the Universal Service Fund section of the bill because it expands the USF without addressing the needed reforms on the distribution end. I believe that universal service subsidies play a critical role in bringing communication service to rural, high-cost areas. But in a communications industry that is growing more fiercely competitive each day, Congress should really struggle to keep universal service fund minimum because fundamentally USF has been set up to help narrowly defined groups at the expense of consumers as a whole.
Finally, and by far the most controversial aspect of the bill, concerns net neutrality, or non-discriminatory access of all users to the internet that is not impeded by broadband taxes. Net neutrality proponents say the bill would create a two-tiered system that could allow broadband providers to charge extra for preferential and speedier delivery of internet content. Democratic Senator from California, Boxer, strongly supported provisions of the bill that would uphold maximum net neutrality possible.
If we don't do this right, we're going to have a lot of people not able to access the internet, and it's a very unfair system. Mr. Chairman, I would say if we don't do something on net neutrality, it would be akin to you're going to take your car onto the highway, you've done it every day, you've got 15 minutes to get to work, you're blocked from getting on the highway. Suddenly a car comes behind and all the trucks that are blocking the highway part for that car. You think it's time for you and you still can't get on the highway.
However, Republican Senator Sununu of New Hampshire opposes neutrality-related or any other regulation of the industry.
We don't know where the industry is headed or technologies are headed or services are headed. And for that very reason, we should be very careful and reluctant to regulate the internet. We should be very careful and reluctant to create technology mandates, and there are some in this bill.
Democratic Representative Markey from Massachusetts held a news conference today in which he presented his amendment to ensure strong internet neutrality provisions that would prevent what he calls stifling the openness of the net by creating broadband haves and have-nots.
We have no problem if one consumer wants super high bandwidth and wants to pay $100 a month for it, while another only needs $20 a month speed. But once they buy their connection to the internet, don't start to limit access to certain content based on whether those internet destinations also paid new fees and broadband taxes to the telephone companies.
His initiative was supported by the musician Moby, who was speaking on behalf of artistic community.
And there's a reason that people's favorite websites such as Google, Amazon, eBay, Craigslist are all fighting together to preserve net neutrality. If Congress guts net neutrality, independent music and news sites would be choked off. Consumer choice would be limited and the internet will become a private toll road auctioned off by companies like AT&T. And that's why there's this huge, huge public backlash going on.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Anastasia Gnizditskaya in Washington, D.C.
The Nepalese parliament declared itself the supreme cradle of authority today, reducing King Gyanendra's power. Yet the control of the country seems to have slipped into the hands of the Maoist guerrilla leaders, whose parallel government holds the most sway over the psyche and physical resources of the people. Maoist guerrillas have stepped up their extortion spree and are garnering money from anyone who owns something, leaving even the parliamentarians vulnerable. PC Duby reports.
Some of them have stated this on the very floor of the parliament. Maoist supremo, Prachanda, has unambiguously conceded that they collect donations during an interview on a Maoist-run FM radio a few days back. He has, however, given cogent reasons for the same.
We have thousands of soldiers of our people's army. We need hundreds of thousands of rupees per day to maintain them, to provide Medicare to them. So we are forced to levy taxes where we have our people's government and collect donations from towns and markets.
Sushil Shashank, a social analyst, says that Maoists have erected a gigantic cobweb of military and political organizations having around 30,000 full-time armed guerrillas and 50,000 party cadres. He claims that Maoists have nearly an annual budget of some 10 billion rupees, which they raise through various means.
Maoists collect funds from three major sources. The first is the multi-billion rupees smuggling racket of forest produces and marijuana. No smuggler can take anything out of country without paying 20% of their earnings to the Maoists. The second source is the huge foreign donations to the tune of 7 billion rupees, which innumerable NGOs receive annually. These NGOs cough up 15 to 20% of their donation money to the Maoists, otherwise they can't run programs in remote areas. And salaried persons, both in public and private sectors, trading community and business houses, constitute the third source of their funds.
Sanjeev Kumar, a teacher in the southern Nepalese district school, says that even a person like him, with a meager salary of 5,000 rupees, has to pay 20% of it per month as protection toll to the Maoists, which they call donation.
Maoists tell us that they are running people's government since we pay tax to the royal government. What is the problem in giving something to the people's government?
Maoist Chief Prachanda, however, has a unique antidote against their extortion spree.
This government was formed due to the power of people's movement. It should allocate 50% of its budget for development of rural people and upkeep of our people's army. This is our claim.
Prachanda's such a statement gives an inkling that Maoists are in a position to dictate terms to the political elites now perched at the helm of government because of their armed cadres. The political elites, heading the constituents of the 7 parties alliance, don't wield enough clout to win mass votes at any future hustings, which would be held sooner or later. There looms a big possibility that Maoists would eventually grab control of now all-powerful parliament and form a government of their own. The political parties are threatened with a peripheral role in the polity of the country in the long run. Maoists may shun annihilating the political parties because they have to front to the world that they are wedded to multi-party democracy and electoral politics. Ravikant Mishra, a political analyst, envisages such a political scenario and explains the reasons for it too.
The 7-party alliance leaders are in jubilation at the moment, but gradually Maoists would overwhelm them because Maoists have far, far better political and military networks with committed and honest cadres. They garner billions of rupees every year, though through dubious means, but they are very transparent and equitable in sharing the booty. But the political parties are mere paper organizations, full of mercenary elements, who always remain on the prowl to loot their state coffers. Against this backdrop, I can vividly see that both multi-party democracy and monarchy are in jeopardy. Maoists are going to rule the country. I don't know it will be good or bad for the country. We can only wait and watch how the future unfolds.
It appears the government may not be in a position to comply with the demand of separate budgetary allocation for the Maoist guerrillas, and their extortion spree would continue. Even if the Maoist government peace talks succeed and the guerrillas relinquish arms, the people in remote parts of the country would not be able to shed off the fear, psychosis they have been living with for past 10 years of Maoist insurgency. From Kathmandu, I'm PC Dubey for Free Speech Radio News.
Thank you.
It's Brother Cornell West. I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays bare the truth and inspires you to fight for justice.
The city of Seattle is asking itself if the public financing of sports stadiums is good public policy. Deciding whether to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on sports teams or to fund low-income housing, classrooms, transportation, and open spaces. Martha Baskin reports.
Okay, so the targeted audience was a no-show on the steps of City Hall, but that didn't stop community organizers from staging a mock farewell to the Seattle Sonics. The Sonics and their owner, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, want the city to pony up $220 million to renovate Key Arena. They also want a bigger revenue cut. Organizers say the money could be better spent renovating schools, building low-income housing, and repairing the city's overstressed highways and bridges. Rick Harris, editor of Real Change, Seattle's paper for the poor and homeless, noted that income for the top 20% in the city rose by 56% last year. That's a problem, he said, because income for the poorest fell. Harris said he thought about it and came up with a better idea.
So what I think we need to do is take that $200 million or so and invest it in the Seattle Maritime Fund for the poor and homeless.
The community organizer's primary goal was to encourage the mayor and city council to not give in to the team's demands. The last two times sports teams demanded big money, and in spite of the public voting against it, the city and the state caved in. Organizer Rachel Myers.
I think that's why the Sonics are asking. I think they can get that. And we're trying to give the city backing and say, we've done it twice. It was a bad idea probably those times, and it's really bad idea the third time.
Seattle Weekly columnist Rick Anderson, who's written extensively on the issue, says the total cost to taxpayers with interest could be between $400 and $500 million.
Essentially, what we have is a group of millionaires. They're actually, their personal worth is probably $2 billion, so they could write a check for this if they wished.
The Sonics' principal owner, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz, has proposed to contribute $18.3 million towards the new arena. Anderson says that at that level, the millionaires would be chipping in about 4.5% in return for a master lease to take all the profits from the public facility. But the tide may be changing. The state has refused any funding, and the city council and mayor have told the Sonics' ownership that they have to come up with considerably more money, at a minimum $100 million. It's an unusual stand. Again, Rick Anderson.
First time that in this city where this kind of thing has happened, most cities are held hostages by these professional franchises who immediately raise threats and say they're going to move and it's going to kill the economy and a lot of things that just aren't true.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting in Seattle.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Shannon Young is our headlines editor. Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. You can find archives of our newscasts and documentaries online at fsrn.org. From KPFK in LA, I'm Maura Bogado.